there was a guy who had this famous piece of art that he needed to sell. So he went down to this art dealer and said, I want you to sell this. And the art dealer said, okay, here's a 30% commission agreement. They signed the commission agreement. And the next day, the art dealer called the owner of the art and said, I've got it sold for you. And the owner of the art came down and said, well, this is kind of interesting. You just charged me 30% to do a deal overnight. And the art dealer said, yes, but it took me 25 years to know who to call.
Welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings, the number one show about growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. Now, here's your host, Mark Allen Kenny.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings. I'm Mark Allen Kenny. Our guest today is Gene Trowbridge. How are you doing today, Gene?
I'm doing great, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you so much for being here. Gene is the founding partner of Trowbridge Law Group, LLP. Gene's law practice concentrates on the syndication of commercial and investment real estate through both debt and equity. Between Gene's individual syndication practice and the firm's legal practice, the partners in the firm have written offerings for more than $5 billion of money raised. Gene, thank you so much for being on the show today. Could you please tell the listener just a little bit about your background and how you got started in real estate?
Sure. I really had three careers. The first career I had coming out of college was being a broker selling commercial real estate. And I did that for a while. And while I was doing that, I bought a few single family houses for my own investing. And back in the Twin Cities at that time, and the management of those houses became, I thought, overwhelming. So I thought if I could just get 10 of them and stack them on top of each other, it'd be a lot easier. So that sounded like an apartment building, right? But then when I found the apartment building, just like every other syndicator in the world, I didn't have enough money to do it myself. So I had to reach out, and I reached out to three guys I went to college with. And we bought an apartment building in St. Paul, and that was kind of the start. So then my second career was really just full-time syndicating, and I did that for about 15 years. Gave up the brokerage business, moved to California, and became a full-time sponsor. Most of the deals we did were buying dirt and building storage facilities, self-storage facilities. And we'd buy them, we'd buy the dirt, we'd build them. We would get them 50 to 60% absorbed, occupied, and then we would sell them to the long-term operators. We were not in the business of operating storage facilities. My investors and I were interested in making equity buildup, not cash flow. So I did 16 syndications, which involved about 24 properties. As you could tell, some of the syndications had more than one. And the height, I had 850 investors. And at the height of my insanity, I sent out 1,676 K-1s one year, which was a lot. So I had a lot of investors investing in more than one property. So that became a burden. In those days, there were no back office companies to help you with all that work. So I faced an issue of maybe I need to do bigger deals, do fewer deals, get some more office space, hire some more people. Mark, I did what many people do. We went home, got my wife, we sat down at the kitchen table where all the great decisions in life are made. And I said, you know, what am I going to do for the next 15 years? I don't really want to do this anymore. I don't want to grow, which is just kind of me. Well, we had two kids in grade school. My wife was working and I'm off to law school in the evenings.
Wow.
And at 45, I passed the bar. And so my 15-year legal career, I'm now in year 27 of that. And hashtag not retiring. Yeah. So there we go. So three awesome careers, broker, syndicator, and now doing the legal work for syndicators.
Awesome. Right on. Well, thank you for being here. Let's dive right in. I mean, I was excited to have you on the show just, you know, to talk about the legal work that you're doing. And, you know, I think it's really important for operators and passive investors to be educated on the different legal docs that are involved in a syndication or any type of deal, really. But I'd love to just, you know, pick your brain and get your expertise on, you know, what investors should be looking for in different documents. What is a PPM? What's the difference between that and an operating agreement? I'm happy to start wherever you think makes sense. But if you can kind of give maybe an overview of the different legal docs someone can be expected to sign when they invest in a deal, and then we can just kind of take it from there.
Sure. Well, I think the first document that they should look at, and I'm not going to talk about the property package. I'm not going to talk about the real estate. I'm going to talk about the securities aspect and how you raise money, how the sponsor gives documents to the investors and how the investors look at those and then turn around and send in their money. Okay. The first thing the investor should look at is the private placement memorandum, which is the disclosure document. And sometimes people lump three documents together when they say private placement memorandum, but I'm going to keep it separate. The private placement memorandum, the PPM I'm talking about, is the story. Here's the story of what we're going to do. It's really not a legal document at all. It's just that in the securities law, the major issue and the major goal is full disclosure. So the sponsor is responsible for giving the investor all the material facts ahead of time so they can make an informed decision before they invest. And where do you do that? You don't do that over the telephone. You don't do that in emails. You put it in a PPM, and it's the same PPM that goes to all the investors. Everyone gets the same information, the final version, the same information at the same time. And in that private placement memorandum, it talks about the business plan, the conflicts, the risks, the cash distribution, the sources and uses of the cash, liquidity, how do we deal with disputes, how do you vote, all the things that will eventually show up in the operating agreement as the rules of how we run the entity. And Mark, the PPM only gets signed by, if this was your offering, you would sign the PPM and send it out. No investors sign the private placement memorandum, not at all. So when I work with sponsors, I try to get that PPM done first and send it to them. If we have the story right, then it's easy for me to draft the operating agreement. What's the operating agreement? That's the rules. That really is the legal document that binds the sponsor to the investors and the investors to the sponsor. And it goes somewhat through the story and says, okay, we said we were going to split cash 80-20. Now, in detail, how do we do that? And that covers everything. So if you read the story and you understand the story from the PPM, then when you get into the operating agreement, it's not going to sound so legalese to you, because it is legalese. But I know in our company, I've worked for many, many years with many partners to try to make our operating agreement as plain English as possible. And we're always struggling for that. So the operating agreement tells a story. Now, if you're interested in investing, what do you do? Well, you fill out the subscription agreement, which, Mark, is just kind of like your offer. Okay, Mark, I've read it. I'm okay. I've asked you all the questions I want to ask you. You've given me the answer. Here's my offer to invest $50,000 with you. And in support of my offer, I'm going to fill out this questionnaire so you have information about me. Now, most of the time, you already know me because we're doing an offering where there's no advertising and you have a pre-existing relation with me. So you know me, but for record keeping purposes and purposes of the SEC, we go through the questionnaire. You know, who am I? How old am I? How am I going to take title? Am I accredited? Do I have investment experience? All the way down the line, blah, 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 blah. And I send that to you. And if you accept me, you cash my check. And then I'm a member. Now, in our documents, Mark, the only thing the investor signs is the subscription agreement. We don't have them sign the operating agreement. The sponsor does. You would sign your operating agreement. And then in the subscription agreement, it says, hey, I've read everything. I've asked Mark all the questions I need to. He's given me all the answers. I actually attest to the fact that I've read everything and I'm comfortable, and all my answers on the offering questionnaire are true, and we have them sign that. That methodology has come around because many of my sponsors use some sort of a back office company where they upload the documents, they send the documents to the investors electronically, and they really only want one signature coming back. So we've structured it so it is the subscription booklet that is the signature. And then what the sponsor does, if they accept, they will send you a receipt and acknowledgement that you're in the deal and we collected your $50,000. Now, how about that? That was about maybe 120 to 150 pages of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was great. Thank you for that breakdown. That was simplifying a lot of complex information. So yeah, that was awesome. So let's dive in a little bit. So what should passive investors be looking for when they review these documents? I mean, you know, there in some cases, you know, people like to see what are the acquisition fees? What are the asset management fees? Are there construction management fees? Is that listed typically in both the PPM and the operating agreement? Or where's the best place to pinpoint those questions?
Well, the first place is in the story, because the story will tell you, probably in our documents, there's a table of the fees, relatively shorthand, but it's a table. But when you get in the operating agreement, then it's in paragraph form. And we go into a little bit more detail. But even before that, here's what I think a passive investor should ask. And if we have any sponsors out there, I think it'd be a good idea to listen to this, because if they ask you, you better have an answer. Okay. The first thing, Mark, I want every investor to do is to ask Mark or read in the book and find the answer to this question. Mark, if I give you my money, what happens if something happens to you?
Sure, yeah.
And so what I'm looking for is continuity. The managing member has to be more than one person. I won't write an offer. I won't take a client on if they insist that they want to be the individual managing member because it's too risky for the other investors. All sorts of things happen to people, and you know, you don't have to die to have a problem. You can be sued. You can... go bankrupt. You can get divorced. I had a guy hit his head on a rock in skiing in Park City, and he came back a quadriplegic after a year in traction. And we have had someone die. So then what do you do? Well, you can't just say, well, we'll let the investors vote on who the next person is. Investors don't want to be the next person. And the lender won't go for that anyhow. The lender will force you into having something called a springing member. So you might as well have two people in there. And I think we should, for the sponsor, we should protect the sponsor and put him in him or her in an LLC. Because when the sponsor goes up and becomes a member of the LLC that buys the property, along with all the other members, if the sponsor doesn't have that LLC blanket around them, then the investors can sue the sponsor individually for all their assets. So that's the number one question. Is there continuity?
Right, right.
And then as you're reading the documents, the number two question I think I'm interested in and is they should be interested in. Hey, Mark, have you done this before?
Sure.
So that I think that's pretty important. And then the third thing I think they should look at is if this is a good enough deal, is Mark in it? You've heard the phrase skin in the game. Well, there's two ways that Mark can have skin in the game. Mark can invest cash just like everyone else. And Mark probably is going to sign on the mortgage. So sure, even if it's a non-recourse loan, I don't care. You're still signing on the mortgage. So I think that's something that needs to come out in your studies about the offering. And then the fourth question an investor should ask is about liquidity for the investor. Not only can something happen to the manager, but you may have 30 people who sign up to do this deal and you've got a holding period of 5 to 7 years. What are the chances, Mark, of someone in that group of 30 people having a life event and coming to you for their money? Pretty damn good, I'll tell you. Pretty damn good. And so there needs to be a discussion of voluntary liquidity or involuntary liquidity. So those are the most important things. And then you're absolutely right. We need to disclose. Remember, the security law says we need to disclose all the important facts to the investors before they invest. And one of the facts would be, what are the fees? Full disclosure. Full disclosure. What are we going to do with the money? How much are we going to raise? How are we going to spend it? What are the fees? How do we vote? All those things are in the story. But I'm more interested in those first four questions to start with, kind of in the other things, because quite honestly, most of the syndicators out there better be using a syndication attorney, a professional to help them. And so you won't find a lot of things that are out of the ordinary.
So I wanted to rewind just a minute back to what you said about track record. I think that's super important. You know, that's probably the number one question for people with working with an operator for the first time. Is there a legal way to verify that track record? Because I know some operators, yes, I've done a deal before. I've done, you know, two deals and exactly like this one, but they haven't had an exit, or they haven't had, you know, they haven't actually hit their target returns even. So is there a way to kind of verify what those returns have been? Can you ask for financial statements? Or from a legal perspective, what's the best way to verify that track record?
You just have to ask. Because think about this. We've got an LLC that's just been formed by a property. That LLC has no track record at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've got a manager, and maybe the manager, the two, three people that are in the manager LLC have just come together to do this deal. There's no track record in that manager LLC. But Mark has done some deals, okay? So I, as an investor, have every right to ask Mark for results for his track record. And I think that would be part of the disclosure. And Mark should answer that question. Where I see that most of the time, at least in my documents, I see it in the investment summary, the property package, the OM, which I like my clients to have in a separate document, and I make it an exhibit, because that's always changing. And I don't want to change 100 pages, okay, because you found out that there are four units that need new bathtubs. Okay, I don't want to change that. But we can change the exhibit pretty easily, and it's always changing. Plus, we have the exhibit to start with that you can hand out to your potential investors while I'm working on the other documents to gauge their interest. Talk as pictures and maps and all that, and get the real estate part of it out of the way before the property package comes. And that's where I see the track record. And let's just tell you a story. My most prolific syndicator has done 110 offers in the last 6 years, which I've written. And so what do we do about that track record? We have a narrative. We don't have spreadsheets. We don't do that. We just have a narrative. And there have been some lawsuits. There have been some trouble. And those are the things that absolutely get disclosed in a paragraph form, with the opportunity, if an investor wants more information, they can go right to the sponsor and ask for that. Okay. 20 years ago, there used to be a set of Excel sheets that the SEC published, which actually there used to be something called the Guide 5. And the Guide 5 said, here's how you report your track record. Here's how you do an offering document for real estate. That's gone away. So we don't have that anymore. But that was relatively laborious. And, you know, a bunch of spreadsheets practically have no information. We're not necessarily interested in the good deals. We're interested in the bad deals. And
sure.
And we have a responsibility as attorneys and sponsors to talk about the bad deals. But there's no place, you know, long question, short question, long answer. No place actually to find them unless you get that information from the sponsor.
Got it. Okay. So I also wanted to ask you about kind of the difference between 506B, 506C. I think most operators understand the idea that, you know, 506B, friends and family, 506C, you can advertise, you can work with people you haven't met before as long as they're accredited. Are there any other differences, especially from the passive investor's perspective? Should they be concerned whether it's a 506B or 506C, or does it make no difference to the passive investor?
The only thing I would think it would make a difference is that if I'm an accredited investor and you're advertising, chances are I'm going to be investing with a whole bunch of people none of us know each other, and none of us know you. How does that help you if there's difficulty in the transaction? Where if I'm over in 506B, where there's no advertising and you, the sponsor, have a pre-existing relationship with all the investors, maybe that would help. The documents are pretty much the same. That's a security issue. We would disclose that we're advertising, and we would disclose that everyone has to be accredited. So on one hand, we don't know anyone. On the other hand, everyone who invests is rich and smart. So that might be good. Back to my most prolific syndicator, all 506Bs, no advertising, only accredited investors. And 5 years ago, he stopped taking new investors. So now we have a closed system of investing in all of his deals. And many investors are invested in many deals and know the other investors and have known Jim for 20 years. Well, there's some comfort there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he doesn't want to advertise because he doesn't want someone new to come in and screw up everything. But as far as the paperwork, other than a couple disclaimers that we're advertising, there's really no difference in the offerings at all.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. Awesome. I also wanted to ask you about 1031 exchanges. You know, what are your thoughts on that? What are the flexibility there with syndications and what's possible? I know not a lot, but very few sponsors even accept a 1031 exchange in their offering. Sometimes they can do it in a tenants in common. What's kind of your thoughts on 1031 exchanges in relation to syndications?
The reason it even comes up so much, Mark, is that if you invested in 2012 or 2013 and you still have your property, you've made a lot of money. So you have a lot of gain, taxable gain. So the 1031 rule lets you move your equity from one piece of real estate to another piece of real estate and avoid reporting the gain. So any tax on the gain would be deferred to a later date of reporting. Okay. That's the 1031 rule as we see it today. And so it's very, very popular today. The problem is in 1031, you start out today with a piece of real estate. You have a deed, you have a piece of real estate. You sell the real estate, the cash goes to an accommodator, a third-party intermediary. Then you find another piece of real estate. That third-party intermediary buys that other piece of real estate on your instructions and gives you a deed. So visualize this. In the morning, you have a deed on one property. The afternoon, you have a deed on another property. What happened? All you did is move your equity from one piece of bricks and mortar to another one, from one apartment to another one. So if that's what you did, you never took control of the money. Your money's just in a different property. So the rules are written that you can defer your gain. Problem is, today you have a deed in real estate. The money goes to the accommodator. The accommodator buys you 400 units in Trowbridge Equity Group, LLC. That doesn't qualify for an exchange because the interest in the LLC doesn't give you a deed. It gives you shares. It gives you units. It's personal property. It's not real property. And in the language of 1031, it's not like kind. You have to go from real estate, one deed, to real estate, another deed. So you just simply can't buy units in the LLC with your cash and get tax deferral. You can certainly buy the units, but you don't get tax deferral. So how do I deal with that? And we do one of these every month. I need to give you a deed. So how do I give you a deed? I give you a deed as a tenant in common to a partial ownership of the property that we're buying. You have a deed. The syndication raises money from all the investors, and the syndication has a deed. So in my example, let's say you brought in $1 million from your exchange, and I syndicated $1 million, and we put $2 million down and bought a property. You would have an undivided interest of 50%. Totally yours. It's not wrapped up in mine at all. You get half of the cash. You have your own voting rights. You make your own decisions. And my syndication has half. We have a deed. We have half of the cash. We have our own voting rights. We have our own cash distribution pattern. And none of our interest is diluted into yours or vice versa. So your sponsors who will accommodate someone in an exchange will go for tenants in common. There are very good reasons not to do that. Because now we have two deeds and your syndication can't tell me what to do with my deed. I can't tell you.
Yeah. So does the PPM, the subscription agreement, does any of that come into play with the other party with the tenants in common structure?
I would write a PPM explaining that this is a tenant in common investment and the syndication. In that example I just gave you, my opening paragraph would go through a little bit, be relatively lengthy. Here's what we're going to do. We've got a property. Trowbridge is bringing in $1 million and he's going to get an undivided interest of 50%. He's really not part of the offering. The offering is of the Mark Kenny Fund 1 LLC, and we're going to raise $1 million and we're going to buy 50% of the property. And here's how we're going to manage our deed, our 50%. And then the operating agreement is on our 50%. The rest of the PPM really might talk about generally how are we going to run the property? How does it work when there are two owners? But the operating agreement is just on our 50%.
Sure.
It's very
sure.
complicated for investors to understand that if they haven't seen it once.
Yeah, I would imagine that that's why a lot of syndicators don't do that is because isn't that a liability for the passive investors if they don't know who that other party is? I mean, they would kind of have to vet them.
Absolutely. And it has to be, it has all decisions, because without going too far in it, the IRS wouldn't agree to that transaction if they thought the two 50% owners had formed a partnership, because partnership interests don't qualify for exchange because a partnership interest isn't a deed. So we have to treat the person who comes in with the exchange money as their own property. Every decision has to be unanimous. You could say that each tenant in common has a veto over when we sell it, when we refinance it. And so that's trouble. And most of my clients who go along with that will go along with it if the amount of money coming in is substantial. You know, if you've got enough to buy 5% of the property, go somewhere else. Go out and buy your own replacement property. Don't screw up my deal.
Yeah, awesome.
The last one we did, well, here's where it really worked. There was a property and we had to raise $23 million. So we had an investor who had a corporation that owned a property that they were going to sell. And I think they had like $8 million in equity. Then he had his family trust that owned another property that had $10 million in equity. But we needed $23 million. So my clients raised the $5 million. So now what do we have? We have three tenants in common. We have the corporation, the family trust, both controlled by the same people, but they have $18 million of the $23 million, and then my client has the $5 million. But my client has a professional property management company, and in the tenant in common agreement, we gave that property management company the right to manage day-to-day management. It's just that the property management company doesn't have the ability to do major decisions like selling and refinancing.
It's that time on the show for a segment called Best Deal, Worst Deal, where we talk about real estate transactions that you've done in the past so that others can learn from your knowledge and expertise. So, Gene, with that said, what's the best real estate deal that you've done?
I represented a client who raised $150 million in 30 days in a blind pool to buy freestanding surgical centers around the United States. How did they do that? Well, over the years, they developed some relationships with registered investment advisors. And when the offering came out, they knew exactly who the advisors were, and the advisors had all the clients. Right? So everything was teed up. They went to the advisors, and in 30 days, they raised $150 million without advertising, 506B, because the advisors had the relationship with all the clients. We didn't need to advertise. How about that?
Yeah, that's amazing.
Now, there's just as an aside, I read a novel once, and in this novel, there was a guy who had this famous piece of art that he needed to sell. So he went down to this art dealer and said, I want you to sell this. And the art dealer said, okay, here's a 30% commission agreement. They signed the commission agreement. And the next day, the art dealer called the owner of the art and said, I've got it sold for you. And the owner of the art came down and said, well, this is kind of interesting. You just charged me 30% to do a deal overnight. And the art dealer said, yes, but it took me 25 years to know who to call.
Mm.
And that's exactly what happened in that offering. That sponsor developed a network of registered investment advisors and must have known that that was a product that they were looking for. And when we structured the cash distribution and all, he had an absolute idea that when he went to them, that's what they were going to buy. So a lot went into that. Just 30 days of raising money was just collecting wire transfers. Okay. Now, the worst deal I ever did, I'll talk about me. One of the biggest mistakes that a syndicator can make is, I believe, thinking you always have to have a product on the street. Because if you don't have a product on the street and some investor has some money and they call you and say, what do you have? And you say, I don't have anything today. Well, they might call Mark and they may invest in Mark's deal and you may never see that investor again. When I was doing syndication, I was raising all my money through the broker dealer community, through stockbrokers. And I didn't know any of the investors, but I knew the brokers. And I felt exactly that way, that if I didn't always have a product on the street, I would risk that broker would put his investor in someone else's product and we'd lose that investor and maybe even lose the relationship with the broker. So I did a deal to build a little office building. It wasn't a huge deal. I think we raised about $5 million to build an office building in Southern California. And the ground floor tenant was to be a credit union. And now a credit union in California has to have a permit from the state. The permit wasn't quite finished, wasn't quite inked. I had an opportunity to go to a financial planning conference where I had a booth and I knew my competitors were going to have booths all around me. I couldn't stand there and not have a deal. So I inked the deal. I went ahead. I raised the money. We built the building and you can imagine what happened. They never got their permit.
Mm.
Okay. So I've got a building that's half empty on an uncovered construction loan because I wasn't going to get permanent financing until I had a lease signed for the tenant on the lower level. That was trouble. We lost money on that deal. Eventually, we lost money. I finally got it leased, and we had to sell it, and it wasn't exactly the same. But I'll tell you, that is a mistake out there, you syndicators. You don't have to have a deal on the street all the time, you know? That can lead you to trouble. So there's my worst story. Thanks a lot for asking those questions, Mark.
You got it. Well, Gene, we're a bit over our time here, but I just want to thank you so much for being here. Thank you for taking the time and offering your expertise today. It's super educational, and I'm sure it's helping a lot of people. So thanks for taking the time today.
You're welcome, Mark. And maybe someday you'll have me back, and I'd like to have a discussion with you about some specific topic. I'd like to talk about the three words.
The three words?
Sophisticated, pre-existing, and substantive.
Okay. Yeah, you got it. We'd love to have you back.
And that's all about 506B. You reach out to me and sometime I'll come back and we'll talk about that. Okay.
Okay. That sounds great. Gene, where can others go to connect with you and maybe even work with you?
Okay. My website is trowbridgelawgroup.com. And so you can send me an email, gene@trowbridgelawgroup.com. I've got a great YouTube channel, Trowbridge Law, with all sorts of stuff on there that you might be interested in. But go to the website, and if you want to call me, have a free consultation, that's great. Thanks, Mark.
Awesome. Thanks for being here, Gene. Have a great rest of your day.
Okay, bye.
Hey everybody, it's Mark Allen Kenny. If you're interested in apartment building investments, schedule a call with me so we can have a chance to chat. My company is focused on growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. So let's hop on a quick call and talk about your investment goals and see if we're a good fit. Find out more at stellarinvestmentgroup.com.